It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX. In the late 1960s, the great scholar of religion, Elaine Pagels, had a religious experience she's still thinking about. It was at a Billy Graham rally.
Was it religion? Was it Christianity? What is it about that that was so powerful? And anyway, who was Jesus? And what do we know about him? How did the movement start?
I'm Anne Strainchamps, and if you strip away the doctrine, the dogma, the rules for how to live, what actually is religion?
I'm interested in the kind of experiential sources of religion.
You're talking about that, what people actually experience that then later turns into a codified sense of religion.
I'm sort of interested in religion before it becomes religion.
This hour, the roots of religion, in personal experience and in forgotten secret histories.
Wisconsin Public Radio. This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Have you ever had an experience so unlikely, so dramatic, so trippy, that you struggled to explain it to yourself, let alone to other people?
I had just pulled into the parking lot of my Houston synagogue with my 4-year-old and my 2-year-old sons in the car. It had been a beautiful late summer day up until that point, when the sky just opened up and the storm just came out of nowhere.
For Elizabeth Crone, it happened in an instant. She tells the story in her memoir, Changed in a Flash.
I told Jeremy, my 4-year-old, to get out and run to the building. There was an awning there over the door, and I told him to wait there for us. And then I climbed over the seat in the car to get Andy, my 2-year-old, out of his car seat. Got my umbrella, pulled it down really close to my head, and we started walking. After a few steps, I felt it. A crackling in the air. I can remember glancing at my left hand and noticing that my wedding ring was touching the metal shaft of the umbrella. A tiny little tine branching off a larger bolt of lightning touched the tip of the umbrella. And this only served to paralyze the muscles in my arm and my hand, and I couldn't let go of the umbrella. And then the larger bolt hit. It was like being inside of an exploding bomb. Andy immediately started screaming and had his hands glued to his ears. Jeremy was also screaming as he ran back out toward us in the storm and grabbed his brother's hand and started pulling him toward the building. And as far as I understood things, I was following my boys into the synagogue. It dawned on me that my umbrella was no longer in my hand. It was lying on the parking lot. It was smoking, and it was just the skeleton of an umbrella. And about 20 feet away from the umbrella, I saw a lifeless heap on the pavement. and I realized I was seeing myself. And I could see that the soles of my shoes had been blown off and the bottoms of my feet were burned. Believe it or not, I was very upset because the shoes were brand new and had been quite expensive. It was at that point I realized there was a bright, warm, inviting glow that appeared to my upper right. It was beckoning me to follow it. So I did. I always have trouble finding the words to describe this, but it was just an unspeakably gorgeous garden. The plants, the flowers, the colors, the aromas, the otherworldly music just filled my senses with peace and contentment. A voice spoke to me and told me to sit on a bench that was there. I was immediately enveloped in an overpowering feeling of truly unconditional love. I have children. I know what unconditional love is, but this was different. It was more potent. And I never wanted to leave this place. There were three violet-colored orbs in the sky. From the way they were moving, I just instinctively knew how much time was passing. I knew that I sat there for 2 weeks. I was given so much information in that time. I understood that while we were all in heaven, heaven was different for each of us. I understood things like reincarnation. I also suddenly understood the nonlinear nature of time. My companion there told me that I could choose to stay if I wanted to, or I could choose to return to my body and continue my earthly life. My 2 weeks in the garden translated to about 2 minutes here on Earth.
Okay, at this point, I just have to say, while I'm glad that Elizabeth's experience of being hit by lightning was not completely awful, you could chalk all that up to hallucination. Except for what happened next.
When I opened my eyes there on the pavement, people were just coming out to help me. For the next few months, I was pretty much off my feet. I slept a lot. And very strange things began to happen that had never happened to me before. I would have a nightmare about a plane crash, and then I would see it on the news the next day. Information about earthquakes, tsunamis, other disasters would come to me, and then they would happen. This is not something I ever would have believed in. People frequently ask me why I didn't talk about my experience for almost 30 years. Who would have believed a woman talking about how she died, left her body, went somewhere else, met and talked to God, and then came back to dream the future? I can't make sense of this at all. I can't explain this. All I can say is it changed me. I believe that death is not the end, although I can't tell you why or how I believe that. I'm sorry. It happened to me, but I can't explain it.
Elizabeth Crone tells her story in a memoir called changed in a flash. For a while, she sent herself time-stamped emails, trying to prove they were really precognitive. Now, I don't know what to make of that, and whether you believe any of it or not, here's the question. Would you call that experience a religious experience?
My experience over and over working with people like Elizabeth is that the first or second or even third story you hear are the easy ones. And if you keep hearing stories, they get weirder and then they get weirder. They never finally make sense.
This is Jeffrey Kripal. He's a scholar of religion with a chair in philosophy and religious thought at Rice University. He collects stories like Elizabeth's. Telepathic dreams, near-death experiences, alien abductions. Stories that would seem to have a lot more in common with cable TV than church. But Kripal believes these are the deep roots of religion. Anomalous experiences that sound crazy and turn people's worlds upside down. Steve Paulson asked, like what?
I could tell you stories of a haunted necklace, of plants that die when their owners die, reading minds.
You're talking about what we would call paranormal experiences.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's not usually what we think about as religion. We tend to sort of put that in an entirely different category.
Well, that's a mistake. You know, the word paranormal is a very new word. It was coined in 1903 by a French scientist. And it's a way, or it's an attempt to secularize and make natural experiences that had always before that had a religious framework. And these experiences happen every day to thousands of people. But we live in a culture that suppresses them in various explicit and implicit ways. And so people don't talk about them. Elizabeth waited 30 years to come out of her closet.
That is not my image of religion. I mean, that's usually talk about God or the Bible or sacred scriptures. That's not what you're talking about here.
No, I think things like God and scripture and tradition are later developments of these same sorts of experiences that then get remembered in a community and they develop into ideas. So, for example, if you had, say, 100 or 200 people like Elizabeth who had a similar kind of near-death experience, you would have stories floating around in the community about how the soul survives bodily death and we have these capacities to receive information from the future. And then you would develop beliefs like the soul, prophecy, divination, that sort of thing. And of course, that's exactly what you see in the history of religions. I'm interested in the sort of sources, the kind of experiential sources of religion.
You're talking about that what people actually experience that then later turns into a codified sense of religion.
That's correct. I'm sort of interested in religion before it becomes religion. These anomalous events or extreme experiences that form the basis of various religious ideas like the existence of a soul. And so my position is that these beliefs are not crazy, superstitious things that silly people make up. These beliefs are the direct outcome of actual experiences.
So how far back does this idea of religion go for you? Does this go all the way back to your childhood?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I grew up in Nebraska in a farming community. I wasn't particularly religious as a boy. I grew up Roman Catholic. But when I hit puberty, I became super, super pious and ended up in a monastic seminary wanting to be a monk.
How long did you last in the monastic seminary?
4 years. And at the end of the day, my monastic mentors thought, and I agreed with them, that I didn't actually have a religious vocation. I had an intellectual vocation and that I needed to go to graduate school and not enter the monastery. So that's what I did.
You've also written about some of the cultural aspects of being in that seminary that didn't fit. I mean, you said that pretty much all the other guys in the seminary were gay and you weren't.
Right. It was definitely a gay community. And by that, I mean, most of the young men were closeted gay men who had turned to the priesthood or the religious life as a way of positively and creatively sublimating that into some kind of spiritual life. And I wasn't gay. I was highly repressed, but I was ultimately straight, and I just didn't fit in.
Was that just kind of a weird quirk of this particular seminary that you were in, or does this say something deeper about the nature of religion?
Well, the argument I make in Secret Body is that this kind of male homoeroticism is orthodox in the history of Christianity, because God is always male. And if you are going to be in love with God or marry Jesus, to use the Catholic language, a male homoerotic orientation works very well. And if you happen to be a straight man, it actually makes no sense. It's an impossible emotional and spiritual orientation to think yourself into.
Wait, you'll have to explain this. What makes homoeroticism sort of this bedrock within Christian history?
Well, you know, in terms of Roman Catholicism now, the institution is controlled by males who are celibate. Many of them are living in all-male or same-sex communities, and they're promoting the love and worship of a kind of alpha male in the sky, i.e. God or Jesus. So they're not worshiping a woman. They're not eating the body and drinking the blood of a woman. And so that privileges or selects for men who have what today we would call gay genders or gay spiritualities.
What does that say about the life of Jesus? How should we read that life? I mean, are you saying there's something homoerotic there?
Yes. I think there's a lot of scholarship on both Jesus and Paul, neither of whom were married. Jesus had a beloved disciple who was another man. Paul wanted all his followers, both male and female, to be virgins and to marry Christ, which is a very queer homoerotic notion for men. I think the origins of Christianity lie in this kind of sexual spiritual orientation that could not be fit in to the heterosexual structures of society.
Are you suggesting that Jesus was gay?
So I think that's an anachronistic question. I think the safest thing to say is that he was anything but straight. He wasn't a heterosexual male married to a woman with 2.5 kids and a golden retriever living in the suburbs.
You do like throwing bombshells, don't you?
But see, Steve, lots of people have said this. There's a whole body of scholarship on this. I'm just speaking about it because it helps explain my own experience in the seminary and my own experience with Christianity.
So you said that the seminary was not the right place for you, went off to graduate school, ended up studying Asian mystical traditions. Why was that so appealing to you?
Well, because I became convinced that there were no heterosexual mystical models in Catholicism or Christianity. Hinduism fascinated me because there were all of these female deities with whom human males erotically unite or spiritually unite. That's really what drew me to it.
Hmm. And you've written about a profound transformative experience you had in Calcutta in 1989. When you say that you became Shiva, can you describe that experience?
Well, you have to know something about the iconography. So what I was actually studying was a tradition called Shakta Tantra. The iconography is a black or blue erotic goddess standing on her husband, Shiva, who is lying prostrate and is imagined as asleep or as in meditation or as dead. And she's often described as erotically engaging him. And during Kali Puja, which was this festival dedicated to this particular goddess, I had just been around the city visiting all the temples and kind of was embedded in this ritual display. And I went to bed and I woke up early in the morning and I couldn't move. I was paralyzed. I was lying on my back exactly like Shiva in the iconography. And this astonishing energy, erotic energy, entered the room or came out of me or came out of something and started to engage my body. And I was entirely conscious. I was perfectly awake, but again, I was paralyzed. My first assumption was that there was an electrical dysfunction in the wall and that I was being electrocuted. That's how strong it was. And then I thought I was having a heart attack and I was dying. And when both of those didn't happen, I sort of surrendered to it, and it sort of imploded into my chest region. And at that point, I had the sensation of leaving my body and floating up to the ceiling in a kind of classic out-of-body experience or near-death experience. And when I eventually got back into my body and could move my fingers and my feet again, I felt as if this tremendous download had been transmitted into my body and my mind. And I couldn't have told you what it was about. I had no idea. I just had this sense that something profound had happened.
You've had a lot of years to think about this. And have you figured out what happened? I mean, can you explain this?
No, I can't. I think the event was infinitely meaningful, and that every book I've written so far has been an attempt to express it, and that that was the point of the experience.
But clearly you don't think this was just, you know, you had an overactive imagination. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that you encountered some kind of transcendent dimension of reality.
Or of myself. I mean, I was electrocuted by some presence, and that electrocution was intelligent and had information in it. And I've spent the rest of my life trying to express that. I totally believe that, Steve. I don't know how else to describe it. I'm not believing anything. I'm not a fan of belief, actually. I think belief shuts us down and gives us easy answers. I'm simply describing what happened and how I've spent my life trying to make sense of it.
Jeff Kripal is a historian of religion at Rice University. He was talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Secret Body. They actually talked about a lot more than we have time for here, but you can read the rest of it in the LA Review of Books. The link is on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, the religion scholar Elaine Pagels introduced the world to the Gnostic Gospels. She's written 8 books about the early church, but she has never talked about the events that animated some of her best-known work, the deaths of her young son and husband.
The things that happened with the loss of my son and my husband were devastating. They kind of were a black hole. I had to put them behind me, though, because my husband and I had adopted 2 babies right before his death. So those things were put way in the background. I simply obliterated them in my mind as a way to survive.
25 years later, Elaine Pagels is ready to talk about grief and loss and the religious imagination. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about the roots of religion this hour and why it's still here in the 21st century.
I was brought up to think that religion was something in the past. It was for people who didn't understand science.
Religious historian Elaine Pagels.
My father had given up the ferocious hellfire and damnation Presbyterianism of his family and became a research biologist. Right in the middle of that, about the age of 14 turning 15, I was living in Palo Alto in California when friends of mine said one sleepy Sunday afternoon, "Well, we're going up to San Francisco today." I said, I'm going.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We welcome you to the beautiful Cow Palace here in San Francisco.
What I didn't know is that it was to meet somebody I'd never heard of.
Thank you. You may be seated.
Billy Graham.
Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? Look at the world's wisdom today.
And he was talking about science.
Our best brains are trying to build bigger and better bombs.
Bigger nuclear weapons.
And engines of destruction that can destroy civilization.
And this is only a couple decades after the Americans had destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
All of our vaunted intellectualism. The scripture says, God has made it foolish.
And I thought, whoa, I was brought up to think that science is the highest wisdom.
There is no sin in the Bible that the Bible condemns more than the sin of immorality. It is America's great sin tonight.
And then he started talking about Jesus and how you could be born again.
Unless there has come a personal encounter with the Lord Jesus Christ, it means nothing.
You could join a new family, it would be God's family, leave your old family behind. What adolescent doesn't find that kind of exciting?
The choir is going to sing softly, just as I am.
I just loved it when the choir started singing, you know.
You come right now, quick. Get up out of your seat, all over the building.
And I just burst into tears and went up and was born again.
By standing here, I give my life to Christ.
It was great, yeah.
What did you do? Go home and say, Mom, Dad, guess what?
Guess what? I found Jesus. They were really shocked. And then I joined an evangelical church, and I was very much involved in it for quite a while.
All together now.
Now, that is not a story many of us would have expected to hear from Elaine Pagels, the great religion scholar, the woman who popularized the Gnostic Gospels, who's written extensively about misogyny and anti-Semitism in the early church. Well, now, for the first time, she is also writing about her personal religious history. So she picks the story up a couple of years later when one of her best friends, Paul, was killed in a car accident. He was just 16. Was it your first experience of death?
It was, and especially the death of a young person that you've just seen full of energy and life. It was a tremendous shock for all of us. And I went back to my evangelical church at one point, and people said, oh, I'm so sorry, it's terrible. Was he a Christian? And I said, well, no, he was Jewish. He wasn't born again? No. And they said, well, then he's in hell.
Oh.
And I was so shocked. And I thought, you know, that has nothing to do with what drew me to this group. That is something on the basis of what you say about the love of God. It just doesn't make any sense. So I left and I never went back. I was utterly devastated.
But it seems like that death opened up all the deep religious questions for you. You know, what happens after death? Does the soul continue? How do we go on living in the face of tragedy and suffering? And then at Harvard, I think, is when you first encountered the secret gospels, the Gnostic gospels.
Well, I went to New York after that experience because I wanted to become a professional dancer. And when I realized that I wasn't really good enough to do that, that was a few years later. And then I thought, wait a minute, there's something about what happened with that experience with evangelical Christianity, which is a powerful tradition, that really was extraordinary. What was it? Was it Christianity? Was it any religion? I mean, what is it about that that was so powerful? And anyway, who was Jesus? And what do we know about him? How did the movement start? When I got to graduate school, I thought I'd find something out about Jesus and what really happened in the early Christian movement. And what I found, what my professors were working on, was a whole discovery of secret gospels that we'd never heard of.
Those are the texts that you've devoted so much of your life to writing about. I think it's fair to say you love them.
Yes. The Gospel of Thomas, for example, really spoke to me in a different way than other Christian sources had. It speaks more to experience than to questions about, do you believe this or that? If you read the Gospel of Thomas, you find the saying, Jesus said, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you.
Hmm.
And I thought, hey, you don't have to believe that. It just happens to be true. Sometimes I see these traditions as Marianne Moore said about poetry. She said, poetry is imaginary gardens with real toads in them. That is, the gardens are imaginary, but there are realities in there that they're talking about. So there may be stories that sound like imagination, but the stories are about real things that we deal with.
These texts, it's almost an ecstatic, very poetic vision of the divine.
Yes.
But then here we are grappling and struggling with with death, with loss, with grief. And as you write in this book, you've lived some of these questions horribly. You married Heinz Pagels, the eminent physicist. The two of you had your beloved first child, Mark, who was born with a heart defect and later a terminal diagnosis. Mark died as a child, and just a year later, your husband tragically died.
In a hiking accident, yes. These were utterly, utterly devastating. And I was just overwhelmed, certainly traumatized. I ended up in the emergency room in Colorado. And the doctor there said to me, "This is acute traumatic stress reaction." Hmm. And I said, "Well, I got through our son's death. I'm going to get through this." And he said, "Don't think that makes it easier. It makes it much, much harder." And it was much, much harder. I mean, losing our wonderful child, he was 6 years old, that was devastating. But when my husband was killed, that's unspeakable, you know. And so I had to struggle for many years. And then we had just adopted two children because right. We had said to ourselves, we're not giving up. The way Mark loved us, we have to give that love to children who need parents as much as we need children. So we adopted two children. One was 2 years old and one was 3 months old when my husband was killed. So suddenly I was left with two babies and no husband, and our child was gone. And I just had to keep going because I felt it was necessary to do that.
I just don't even know what to say. I feel humbled in the face of that kind of suffering and grief. And I'm remembering in the book you wrote that somebody said, "I just can't even imagine how that felt." And you said, "Like being burned alive."
Yeah, that's true. And any parent who's been through that knows it. So these things were literally unspeakable. A friend of mine said, "Well, you're devastated, Elaine. Why don't you write about what you know? Why don't you write about grief?" And I said, "Look, I hate grief. Grief is awful. I don't want to write about grief. I want to write about life and how we get through things." But I couldn't then because I was still very devastated. And it's only after 25 years that I'm able to go back. My children are grown and on their own and doing well, thank goodness. And it's now that I was only able to really reflect on all of those things that happened. And the one thing that happened, you see, is that the means of reflecting on that became these religious traditions. The story of Job, the story of the Gospel of Mark spoke to me very deeply.
Right. The title of your book, Why Religion? I think you're answering one part of why is it's our long inherited collective language for coping with and getting through grief and loss.
The end of the book, I talk about this text found with the Gospel of Thomas, which pictures Jesus literally as a physician, as he's often pictured in the New Testament as a doctor. But here he becomes a physician of souls, and the literal word physicians of souls in Greek is psychiatrist.
I love that.
He becomes a healer of the heart. So for me, you see, one of the things that came out of this is that I don't think about religion so much as a bunch of things to believe in, as a range of resources that we engage and explore and practice. Meditation, chant, music, prayer are all forms of healing the heart. It's a path, the way Buddhism is a path. And it is a practice far before it became a set of doctrines in the 4th century.
How did that help you when Mark was still alive? Because he was diagnosed with terminal illness. He was about a year and a half old, wasn't he?
About two, actually, and right. He lived for 4 more years. He was the light in our life. He was a joy. He was a remarkable child. It wasn't just a terribly tragic story. If it were that, I'd say, why write it? I mean, lots of people have tragedy and sorrow, but it's also a story about joy and about resilience and about hope.
The thing is, a lot of the hope for, I think, a lot of people
is the sense that death isn't final, that something continues. Do you have that feeling?
I often do. It surprised me to have that feeling because it was counter to what I had been taught. I was taught that, you know, death is the end. I don't know. But yes, I often have that thought because who knows? There's a lot more mystery to it than we understand. My husband wrote about that at the end of his book.
Are you talking about that passage he wrote in which he said he had a dream of falling off a cliff, which, you know, prefigured his actual falling off a cliff? I don't even know what to make of that.
Well, some people imagined that he predicted his death. I don't think so. You can't climb mountains and not think about the risk.
Yeah.
But I think he had the sense that there is something greater in the universe than what we perceive, and that what we can see scientifically and what we can verify is by no means all of reality. There's much more to it. And that's what these traditions explore. One thing I love about what Heinz and I shared is a sense that science alone isn't enough. Religion is not answering the questions of science. It often doesn't even answer our questions in any definitive way, but it opens them up and allows them to breathe and allows us to be open to whatever we experience at that point.
Well, and you had, after Heinz died and also after Mark died, in both cases, you had, I don't know what to call them. Some people would say they were visions. Some people would say it was connecting, communicating with them after their death.
Many people have those experiences, you know. I can't explain them. I don't know what to make of them, so I didn't try. But I thought I would include them. Experiences I can't explain. I was talking a couple of years ago with a friend who's a poet, Marie Howe, and she had written a beautiful poem called Annunciation. And it was a poem about the angel Gabriel appearing to Mary. And Mary has a sense of an overpowering sense of love of a spiritual being coming to her. So I asked my friend, how did you write that poem? And she said, oh, well, something like that happened to me. But of course, I can't say that.
Hmm.
And I said, why not? She said, that's the last taboo. People will think you're crazy.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, if that's the last taboo, I'm going to write about it.
Yeah. We can't say they're factual exactly. But saying you imagined them also seems wrong because it denies their reality. And so maybe the real problem is the distinction that our culture keeps making between the imagination and reality.
That's right.
And it seems to me that that's kind of the space that you are wanting to inhabit with this book and with all your work, this space that is in between imagination and reality.
When I say I'm exploring the imagination, I don't mean things that aren't real.
Right.
I mean that the realities we experience can sometimes be only articulated, say, in music or poetry or dance or maybe prayer.
Elaine Pagels is a religion professor at Princeton, author of the award-winning books The Gnostic Gospels, Beyond Belief, and a memoir called Why Religion. Coming up, people find all kinds of inspiration in the Bible. Poet Jericho Brown even found a new name.
I was publishing poems under my birth name, which is Nelson Dimery, but I was born a third, so I was born Nelson Dimery III. The name seemed to me a name I was sharing with two other people, my father and my grandfather. I felt this sort of pang. I was like, wow, this isn't really all the way mine. I had a dream where I was in a very crowded waiting room. The receptionist calling people through the door was saying names. She got to the name Jericho. Nobody got up. I said I was going to be Jericho, although I knew that wasn't my name, and she let me through the door. And when she let me through the door, I woke up. I I'm thinking about this dream I just had. It's so weird. I had to pretend I was Jericho to get through the door. And because I was living in New Orleans, no matter what time of night it is, it was always somewhere to go. I got up and I got in my car and I went for a drive and I went into a bar that was in the French Quarter. I met somebody and the guy said, you know, he was clearly, you know, trying to come on to me. And he asked me my name. And I wasn't interested in the guy, so I didn't want to give him my real name. So I told him my name was Jericho. And that's when he said, Jericho is loosely translated, defense. And of course that makes sense, right? Because we know that Jericho is all about the wall that surrounds it, the wall of defense. The wall that Joshua had to walk around for all those days. And so I decided that that would be my name. Right then and there, in that nightclub, in that bar, Jericho.
Jericho Brown. We'll hear more from him after this. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Can a poem be a form of prayer? Jericho Brown would say yes.
Deliverance. In case you have fallen, though I have not shined shoes for it, have not suffocated myself handsome in a tight, bright tie, Sunday comes to me again as it did in childhood. We few left who listen to the radio leave ourselves available to surprise. We pray unaware of prayer. We are an ugly people. Forgive me. I do not wish to sing like Tremaine Hawkins. But Lord, if I could become the note she belts halfway into the fifth minute of the Potter's House, when black vocabulary heralds homemade belief for any kind of havoc, there is deliverance. She means that even after I am not listening, I am not a saint. Because I keep trying to become a sound. Something you will remember once you've lived enough not to believe in heaven.
That's Jericho Brown reading from his new book of poems called The Tradition. Now, as a poet, he's been working with and transforming religious language for some time in very unique and powerful ways. His award-winning collection, The New Testament, for example, includes poems called 1 Corinthians 13:11, Psalm 150, and Hebrews 13. Charles Monroe Kane sat down with him and asked, why his poems so often turn to worship, to the Bible, and to religion?
I grew up in a black church where so much of what I saw and so much of what I heard was a perfect foundation for poetry. There's so much pageantry and pomp and circumstance in the black church, and so much reverence for the way things are spoken and the way things are sung and the way worship happens together among the people in the congregation. So I think one of the reasons why I'm always turning to religion is that I'm always turning back to that feeling that I would get at church when I was a kid, listening to the preachers or hearing someone sing, or the way form in a poem becomes exciting is because it still has surprises. In spite of the fact that we know the poem has a meter or we know the poem has a rhyme, I think that's similar to how in church, in the order of service, you know what's coming next. And yet you don't really know. You know some people are going to shout, for instance, but you don't know when that's going to happen. And you don't know who the Spirit is going to fall on. Even at the level of the line break in a poem, I get to the end of a line and I don't know what's going to come next. And I love reading poems for that reason, because it reminds me of my relationship to faith and to doubt, that we get to the end of the line sort of holding on to the belief that in that moment of doubt, in that moment of the line break, we will indeed get to a landing.
You know, you're mentioning belief. What about worship? In the Baptist church, from your tradition, worship is huge and active and full of vim and vigor. Do you feel that you still have the same level of worship as you would have in the Baptist church?
Well, that's part of what happens in this poem, right? I'm reflecting on the time that worship was paramount in a certain way. And that's why Tremaine Hawkins, that wonderful singer, that really amazing soprano voice, comes up in this poem. And I don't think I've lost that. Obviously, it's not the same as it was in the church that I was growing up in. But I know how to seek it out in my life. And I know how to have moments of excitement and joy, singing, clapping of my hands. And I do want to say this on this radio show. What's really important, I think, to each one of us is that we have the opportunity to sit in our moments of gratitude, right? No matter how down and out we are, we each have some moment where we feel a little good about something. And if we are allowed to observe that moment without shame, if we are allowed to say a thank you, even under our breaths, I think that makes a difference to the way the rest of the day goes and how much gratitude we can have or experience in the future from that moment. So that's really important to me.
Can I read to you from the Bible? Would you mind if I read something from the Bible?
Sure. Yes.
And this is from Romans 12:1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. You have a poem called Romans 12:1. Can you explain how that came from that verse?
Yeah, I was really interested in this idea of the sacrifice of the body, and that the sacrifice of the body should lead to some form of transcendence or revelation or epiphany. That through the sacrifice of our body, you get to heaven, right? I was like, what about the enjoyment of the body?
Yes. Right.
Is it possible to reach heaven without the sacrifice of the body, but also through the enjoyment of the body, right? Through physical, through lovemaking.
Well, let's hear your Romans 12:1 then.
Romans 12:1. I will begin with the body in the year of our Lord. Porous and wet, love-racked and willing. In my 23rd year, a certain obsession overtook my body, or I should say, I let a man touch me until I bled, until my blood met his hunger, and so was changed, was given a new name, as is the practice among my people, who are several and whole, holy and acceptable. On the whole, hurt by me, they will not call me brother, hear me coming, and they cross their legs, as men are wont to hate women, as women are taught to hate themselves. They hate a woman they smell in me, every muscle of her body clenched in fits beneath men heavy as heaven. My body, dear, dying, sacrifice, desirous as I will be, black as I am.
Wow. Oh my God. That's such a powerful poem.
Thank you so much.
As a gay man, don't you just want to like just scream at the church to let you in the door and not judge you?
No. Interestingly enough, there are things that I want for people in the church, but they're the same things I want for everybody, and that's freedom.
Right.
You know, I want people to be free to encounter other people whole and to love them. There was a point in my life where that did sort of manifest itself in a feeling of wanting to scream, but I don't think I feel that way now. I thank God for getting older so that I'm not carrying around anger about something I have nothing to do with. You know, it's really none of my business. I don't like being in situations where people want to legislate my body.
Right.
Why are you making decisions for other people's life? I don't understand.
I would love, I don't have one, but if you could pick a, I guess I'll just use the word good news. If you could pick a poem of the good news and read us one more poem to take us out on that note, would you mind?
You want a happy poem?
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say happy. I said good news. So I'm just saying a poem that has that spirit, you know, they've heard the whole interview now, right? And now the point is let's take them out.
Well, there is a poem, you know, I love poetry. I think this interview's made that evident. But there's one thing that I love more than poetry. And I've always been trying to figure out how to get it into my poem. So the one thing that I love probably more than poetry is cuddling. I think it's the best thing in the world when you could just hold somebody or get held. Anyway, so I wrote this poem and it's about cuddling. So this is the good news. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Stand. Peace on this planet, or guns glowing hot. We lay there together as if we were getting something done. It felt like planting a garden or planning a meal for a people who still need feeding. All that touching, or barely touching, not saying much, not adding anything, the cushion of it, the skin and occasional sigh, all seemed like work worth mastering. I'm sure somebody died while we made love. Somebody killed somebody black. I thought then of holding you as a political act. I may as well have held myself. We didn't stand for one thought, didn't do a damn thing. And though you left me, I'm glad we didn't.
Amen.
That's the good news.
That's the good news.
Jericho Brown, reading from his collection called The New Testament. His new book of poems is called The Tradition. Jericho's the director of Emory University's creative writing program. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. And if you want to hear more poems, you'll find them at ttbook.org. That's it for our show today, but there is always more in our podcast feed. And if you'd like to find out what goes into making this show, what we've been reading and listening to, sign up for our newsletter. Again, that's at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, and Shannon Henry Kleiber. A special welcome this week to the newest member of our team, Angelo Bautista. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strangchamps. Thanks to you for listening.